Good morning. You may be seated. First case on our calendar is 06884 St. Bernard Self Storage versus Hamilton County Board of Revision. Barrett. Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am C. Francis Barrett. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, St. Bernard Self Storage, LLC. Also with me is my partner, Michelle Fleming. We will be splitting our time. The most important point we want to make is this case really starts and ends with the Ohio Constitution. The Ohio Constitution allows real estate to be taxed, specifically stating it's a taxation on land and the improvements thereon. We believe that well-established precedent of this court would mandate that the decision be that the arm's length sale, which was approximate to the tax lien date, must be followed. The Board of Revision found it was an arm's length sale. The Board of Tax Appeals found that it was an arm's length sale. The mistake that both boards made was they refused to allocate the business value from the real estate value. And again, we believe that well-established precedent indicates that the two must be separated. It is not proper to include the value of a business as a part of the real estate.
Are there any cases that would tell us guidelines for distinguishing the value of the realty as opposed to the value of the business entity or the goodwill?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the Willoughby Eastlake case, which was decided by the Board of Tax Appeals, is on all fours with this case. That is, involved a self-storage facility, and there was an allocation in that case between the real estate and the tangible personal property. We have the same situation here. We also believe that the Higbee case decided by this court is dispositive of the issue.
Is the board then bound by the allocation as between the parties, or is the board able to exercise some discretion with respect to the allocation the parties have made in the contract of sale?
Your Honor, we believe that where you have an arm's length transaction, fully negotiated, that allocation, once presented to the Board of Revision and then to the Board of Tax Appeals, is presumptive of that value. And the burden of proof then would shift, in this case, to the auditor and the school board to prove that that allocation is not indicative of fair market value.
Is there any independent evidence in the record by way of comparables, for example, with respect to the value of the realty that I think is $950,000 in this instance to support the allocation that the parties have arrived at in connection with the sale of over $1.9 million?
Yes, Your Honor. After the case was presented to the Board of Revision, in which case our client went to the Board of Revision and simply offered evidence of the contract to purchase, the real estate conveyance fee statement, and other information indicating that this was negotiated, at the Board of Tax Appeals level, our client presented the testimony of an independent fee appraiser, a certified general appraiser who has the MAI designation and the ASA designation, a senior member of the American Society of Appraisers, who independently valued the real estate, and therefore there is evidence in the record in his report. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, before you proceed, could you tell me a little more about the St. Bernard business? I was having a little difficulty quite understanding. Is it only deal with one set of rental units, or are there more involved than just the one involved in what appeared to be this sale?
It's the former, Your Honor. That is the only self-storage facility that's owned by St. Bernard Self Storage, LLC, is this site here. And when our client decided to buy this property, he negotiated with the sellers. There were two tracts involved. There was an allocation of value as to each tract. There was an allocation as to the tangible property and as to the intangible property. And the intangible property included the customer list. It included the trademark, the trade name, the service mark. It included the goodwill, all of those intangibles which enabled him to buy this business. And also, unlike many other self-storage facilities, this one is fully transportable. It is consists of metal buildings which are simply bolted to concrete pads, and it's fully transportable. So when he bought this, he bought a business and the real estate.
If we accept the valuation that they've placed on this, there is then no value given at all to the business side of the purchase. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. The documentation, which includes the contract to purchase, specifically breaks out the value of the business. It is specifically allocated.
I understand your client does.
Yes,
Your
Honor.
But if we accept the Board of Tax Appeals version, they've allocated no value to the buying of a business. Their allocation treats it all as realty.
Yes, Your Honor. Their position is it's inextricably intertwined. And we believe that the prevailing law, the established precedent, is that you must separate the business from the real estate. Their position is we can't separate the business from the real estate. And we believe that just because it's difficult, as the case law would indicate, just because it's difficult to make that allocation doesn't mean it shouldn't be made. Once we presented that allocation, once we presented the independent testimony of a certified public accountant at the Board of Tax Appeals, a certified valuation analyst, an independent real estate appraiser, then the burden became upon the auditor and the school board to refute that. And as the Board of Tax Appeals indicated, they made no effort to allocate, no effort to refute.
The counsel, the concept in general, I think that you advocate has considerable merit on an intellectual level. I'm trying to understand, though, half the transaction price here is attributed to the business, right?
Approximately, yes, Your Honor.
And it's a little difficult for me to get the mental picture of there being, how much of that was goodwill?
Most of it was goodwill.
Okay.
Which includes the name, the reputation, the customer list, all of that is part of the goodwill.
It's hard. I mean, I can understand that for maybe a Dairy Queen, which has a trade name that, you know, there are certain expectations. But self-storage, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around the goodwill of a self-storage place. Did the employees come with the deal?
I believe they did, Your Honor.
That would make some difference. But it seems to me self-storage is a matter of location, which is then that fits with real estate values, location, location, location. And that's not goodwill. That's value of real estate.
Let me answer the question this way, Your Honor. This is a unique setting. This is a unique case. I don't believe there's this catastrophic potential precedent setting value to this case. This self-storage facility is situated, unlike most self-storage facilities, in a very isolated area with very little exposure, has no exposure to the interstate highway system, to the state highway system. It's at the end of a dead-end street in an industrial area, unlike most other self-storage facilities. Therefore, the goodwill is essential. The prior owners built up the name, the reputation, the customer list, the goodwill, and so forth.
It's the customers are located. Is there a nearby surrounding residential area, or what? Where's the customer base?
It's in the general area, and I would also submit, Your Honor, that self-storage facilities, unlike other situations, the other side has talked about this is analogous to an apartment where you have a tenant with a lease, an office building with a tenant with a lease. Well, as with self-storage, it's basically, these are basically retail consumers who are going around looking for a place to store their items. They're not in possession of the property. They go occasionally and put something there, and it's taken care of. It's not the typical tenant situation where they're in control, where they're in possession. And hence, in this case, the business aspect was critical. Our client could take this business and he could move it to another location. It's fully transportable.
With respect to the determination between the buyer and the seller here to allocate roughly half of this to the business value rather than the real estate, were there inherent tax advantages for the seller to do? Who was pushing to make it that large a number?
Your Honor, let me respond this way. That's an excellent point because it counters what the other side is saying. That is, when you have an arm's length transaction, where you have people on both sides that are fully negotiating it, one person's gain becomes another person's basis. So there are consequences both ways.
Your client's the buyer.
Right? Our client is the buyer.
So the lower the number on the real estate, that's a real estate tax advantage, but it's a depreciation disadvantage.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that's why a fully negotiated arm's length sale should be the best evidence of value, and there should be an allocation between the business and the real estate. And if I can make one other point, the question you asked about it's difficult to understand how you can value the business. It is for that reason at the board.
Oh, it's not difficult to understand how you can value a business. It's difficult for me to understand how that much of it could be goodwill when you're talking about self-storage. I guess that's.
I understand that. And let me respond to that by saying that our client retained the services of a fully independent certified valuation analyst and certified public accountant who had no interest in the outcome, no interest in this business, simply valued the business.
And you put all that evidence in.
It's all on the record.
And once you did,
yes,
your argument is at that point, that's credible evidence and the burden is on the other side to refute it.
That is correct. That is our
position. And they failed to do that, is your argument.
That is our position in a nutshell.
Counsel, I have one question about the experts, what they took into consideration in making their determination here. Is this a highly competitive business?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And what evidence was presented in the record to indicate that the goodwill, the relationship, and what has been established in this community constitutes, I guess, a counter or an advantage to that?
Your Honor, in the first instance, there is the testimony of Mr. James Ullman, who was like the managing principal of St. Bernard Self-Storage, and he explained in his testimony, which is in the record before the Board of Tax Appeals, why this intangible value is so important to him because of the competitive nature of the location and what he needs to do, that it's more than the real estate. And secondly, the independent certified valuation analyst did a similar analysis, and that's in the record. And I notice I'm running out of time here, and I wanted to leave some time for rebuttal, but before I sit down, if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Sheevy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and if it may it please the court, we don't dispute that there is a business going on at this facility, but the business they're in is the business of renting space. That's what the Board of Tax Appeals found, and they say it on page 10 of their decision. They say St. Bernard's business is to lease space. The issue in this case is whether or not there exists a separate business value apart from the realty. What we value in Ohio is real property. And Mr. Barrett has referred to the Constitution, and we agree with him, that the task is to value the land and improvements, but the statutes clearly set out the methodology as to how you do that.
Counsel, I would have a little, right here.
I'm sorry.
Counsel, I would have a little better time with your argument if the Board of Tax Appeals had allocated something to a business. Here, they allocated nothing to the business, so essentially, they're saying this gentleman bought land, or this company bought land, and nothing else. Didn't buy a business. Business has no value. That's the effect of the evaluation. If you had said, okay, your 900's too high, we're going to say it's only worth 300 or 400 based on all the evidence in the record, that had been different. How can you explain the zero value given to the business?
I don't think they actually gave a zero value. What they said was there was no separate, transferable, portable business value that was apart from the real estate. The issue really is...
That's the same as zero value because...
Well, it's a zero value as a separate entity for a separate business value that would escape taxation. That's really what we're talking about, because if we whatever we allocate to a separate business value escapes taxation. But
the council has claimed that they could pick these buildings up, unbolt them, move them, the clients, the customer base, to another location. You can't find an appraiser who could have valued that as a separate entity?
Well, no. I think the only one who's claimed that you could easily pick this building up and move it is council. There's no evidence in the record. No expert ever suggested that this was personal property. I specifically asked their appraiser, do you consider this personal property? He said, no, it's real estate. There are a series of buildings.
Well, counsel, I don't know that I understood that they wanted this to be claimed as personal property, the ability to transport these probably pre-constructed, fixtures. But I think that their point, and at least what I understood, was that this is indicia of a business because of the types of improvements that were put on this property in order to establish this business.
Well, as I say, there's no question that there's a business. The question is there a separate business value? And when the business is, in fact, the real estate, the business here is simply to lease space. They do nothing else at this facility except lease space.
Well, counsel, if they had open spaces set up without roofs, without locking ability, security, et cetera. They just had this land, this 4 acres, parceled off and divided up into little cubicles. That's essentially, you're saying that would equate what they've already done here. And you're not attributing any value to the business improvements that were necessary to this land in order to have this business functional and serve a purpose for the community.
No, this business is like an apartment building. It's like an office building. People construct apartment buildings. They construct office buildings. They rent space in those buildings. What we are taxing is the rent from the building. When we talk about business value, we're talking about something that goes on in the building. For example, Mr. Baird's law office. He could operate downtown Cincinnati or out in the suburbs. It doesn't make any difference because he has an established reputation. His clients are going to follow him. He doesn't need that building. But this self-storage facility needs this building. You can't sell the business without the buildings. You can't, for example, tell people that, in this case, the owner, Mr. Ullman, and I made this point below, he can't say, I'm going to move from St. Bernard over 20 miles to the other side of town, and my business is going to follow me. They're not going to follow him because this is a business that, as our expert below, Dr. Miller, says, is measured by counting rooftops. It's locationally dependent. People store their stuff in self-storage facilities for a temporary business, a temporary duration. These client or customer list, as was pointed out, is about a 3-month duration. People, they're moving from an apartment to a house, or they're moving from New York to here, and they're storing their stuff temporarily for 3 months. That's a customer list that their expert says is worth almost $1 million.
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is.
That these are transients,
yes,
that are only there for 3 months?
Yes, they're typically a 3-month customer list.
So is it your position there's no goodwill to this whatsoever?
There's none. Their position is it's worth almost $1 million. Our experts said you could simply send out a flyer in the neighborhood and get the same customer list that they have that's only gonna last for 3 months. How can something that's only gonna last for 3 months, by the time they sell it to the new buyer, the customers have turned over. So whatever customers existed at the time aren't going to be there 3 months from now. So
is there any authority that says goodwill is a part of real estate? Do you have any case that would say that? It would always seem that it's different.
Well, I think it's a fact question. There could be goodwill if you proved it. But in this case, this is a very small community. The only so-called proof of what the goodwill was they had an independent, so they said, although it was somewhat questionable because he admitted, the CPA admitted, that he came in after the fact, and he testified he came in after the fact to validate the sale price. So it wasn't totally independent. They said, here's what we paid for it. Will you come in and validate it? That's the word he used, to validate the sale price. There's other so-called expert, the MAI. He essentially said the real property, and I think this is an important distinction, that real property includes certain intangibles. As we look at the statutes, 570102, that defines improvements, it talks about the rights and privileges appertaining thereto. If you look at 571303, it's the auditor's value, auditor's duty to value real property includes the rights and privileges.
Well, how did the MAI value the real estate?
Well,
what number did he give?
Well, he has basically five different numbers. His first number, where he does sort of the traditional approach to valuing real property, he says it's worth about $1.7 million, and he does all the cost and sales. And interestingly, he relies on five sales comparables. None of those five sales comparables separate business value or goodwill. So that's an indication that no such thing exists in the market. And then after he gets the $1.7 million, he says that's what it's worth. Then he says, how can I determine what the business value is worth? And then he takes off on three different tangents, which he admits are novel approaches that aren't supported by any text. And I asked him, I said, well, this is essentially what you would call the Fletcher method. Mr. Fletcher is the appraiser. And he says, well, that's right. This is something he invented to come up with a method of getting from the $1.7 million down to almost half that. And it's the Board of Tax Appeals gave it, actually, they didn't even think it was worthy of discussion. But when you look at it, before he does this sort of the rest of the story, after the $1.7 million, his $1.7 million, our appraiser's at $2 million, and the sale price is right in that ballpark. So everybody is right in that $2 million ballpark that it's sold for. And you know, I think the Board of Tax Appeals—
Mr. Sheet, the argument that's made is there was an independent expert testimony to verify the $950,000 real estate value, and you did not present any witnesses to counter that.
Well, we did, actually. We also had a real estate appraiser who said the value of the property independent of the sale was $2 million. And the Board of Tax Appeals also said they weren't going to rely on our appraiser, but they said it corroborated the sale price, which it does. And in fact, their appraiser's original value of $1.7 million tends to corroborate the sale price as well.
You're challenging Mr. Barrett's argument to us that there's nothing to rebut the evidence in the record.
Oh, I think there's a lot to rebut. There's our expert appraiser. There's also Dr. Norman Miller, who's the head of the real estate department at the University of Cincinnati, who's—they attempt to belittle him in their brief, but Dr. Miller is really the expert who teaches the experts. Most of the MAIs in Cincinnati, probably younger than I am, have learned their trade from Dr. Miller.
In the larger picture, when you look at an existing self-storage business operating and compare it to one that has just become a fledgling new building, new site, would you say there's no value to one that's existing and operating? And if both were 4-acre parcels and both had 100 units, regardless of the fact that one was generating thousands or hundreds or tens of thousands of dollars, they'd both be sold for the same amount? Isn't that really the essence of what you're arguing to us?
Well, in a sense it is, but
there's no value to an existing operating business.
Well, if you look at a brand new building, which we would typically use a cost approach, the cost approach would factor that potential into it. So even if you looked at what would it cost you to construct a brand new building versus what would it cost you to buy one, the seller, the developer of that brand new building is going to generally sell that building for more than what it costs him to build it, because if it's only worth what it costs him to build it, there'd be no reason to build it.
Well, that's really not the question I asked you. What I asked you was, do you not see a difference between an existing productive money generating business in the self-storage area as composed to one that hasn't yet operated?
Well, it
Wouldn't one be worth more than the other?
It conceivably could be worth more because you're buying the time factor that you wouldn't have to invest time to develop the business. But in this business, even given that, though, that's not a separate, severable business value. It appertains to the real estate. The business, when the business is to rent space, that's real property. If you have income that's generated in the building, for example, if you have a warehouse where Procter & Gamble makes soap or Nike makes shoes, we're not going to tax how many shoes they sell or how much soap they sell because that's a business that's in the building. But if we're going to tax the income from the building, what does it cost Procter & Gamble to rent the building, assuming they rent it, or somebody else to rent that building? That's real property. We tend to use real estate and real property interchangeably. I think that's part of the problem below.
Mr. Shev, could I please understand, when you analogize to the apartment building, for example, and you're saying that this rental storage business is similar to the rents on a apartment building?
Yes.
So that when the apartment building is sold for a fair market value, if the contract between the buyer and seller would include an amount for intangibles, you would say that was inappropriate as well?
It would be a fact question as to what the intangibles are. I think here there really are no intangibles. If in fact there was a goodwill, if in fact there was a value to the name, and I think below Dr. Miller talks about the Golden Lamb restaurant. I don't know how many are familiar with that, but it's sort of a famous restaurant in Lebanon, Ohio, halfway between Columbus and Cincinnati. And it has mostly waitresses that have been there forever and the same chefs. So if you sold the Golden Lamb restaurant and you said you can keep the name, you can keep the chef, you can keep the help because everybody likes the waitresses they've been going to for 50 years, that may have some value. But if you sell an apartment building, you're not selling any of that. You're simply selling someone the ability to live in those apartments, to live in that office building. And they have a staff, too. The other side tends to say that this self-storage facility is very labor-intensive. It's actually just the opposite. These are really cash cows where people come up and they see the manager once. They say, there's your space, number 27. Put your stuff there, and when you're ready to move into your house, you come and unlock it and leave it. That's the testimony below is the only time you ever see the owner is when you rent it and when you leave. And the only staff they have is, I think, maybe a college student that cuts the grass. And it's just the opposite of being labor intensive. So there's no real separate business going on here.
Counselor, I'd like to explore the analogy issue here. It's been alluded to several times, and I think it might be helpful if there is any case law on it. You mentioned the office building, for example, assuming one building and the only business is leasing that particular building. Does the case law generally provide any goodwill or value separate from the real estate and improvement value in that situation?
There aren't, frankly, a whole lot of cases to deal with this goodwill issue. It's frankly very, very seldom seen as an allocation, and I don't think I've ever seen an allocation like this where someone has sort of arbitrarily allocated half the
value. So in your experience, what did you do this sort of regularly before the?
Yes.
In your experience, is there usually a value other than real estate value on a office building that's valued?
No. In fact, I've never seen it.
All right. What about, you're talking about apartment building. What about apartment building?
Never seen it there.
All right. What about, a single motel, the St. Bernard Motel, owned mom and pop, in the same location. Is there a business value apart from the real estate?
It would be doubtful. I think the only time that you could make an argument that there would be a business value is if you had a franchise, you had a Hyatt franchise. But even there, you pay a franchise fee. And in this case, it's the value of the so-called business has already been deducted. So when we do our income approach, all the appraisers, they take the income that's generated, and then they deduct from that the management fees, the labor fees. They're already deducting the value attributable to the so-called business. What Mr. Fletcher does, their appraiser, is after he does that, he says, well, I'm going to do it again. So he's really double counted whatever attributes there are in the business value.
Mr. Sheevy, you've used all 15 minutes of your time, so you better close now. And I'll give Mr. DiMuzio a minute, but because we've asked you a lot of questions, but okay. You've used your time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. DiMuzio, take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our position as a school district is very similar to Mr. Sheevy's, but we feel strongly that current precedent, the Higbee case we mentioned in our brief, really covers it. This situation where Mr. Barrett's client attempted to put on evidence that was not found to be credible, this court need not launch into new areas of review. In answer to Mr. O'Donnell's question, or Justice O'Donnell's question about the newer and the older business, the same analogy can be used for an office building or an apartment building. Clearly, an office building that's been around for 20 years and full of tenants is worth more than an empty one that's brand new. Doesn't mean there's a business value. It's still basically a real estate issue.
Do you recognize that there is a value to goodwill?
There is a value to goodwill. I don't think there's any goodwill in this situation, Your Honor.
So is goodwill a component of a real estate value in your view?
It is to the extent that if goodwill is related to the location, if goodwill is related to the fact that it's been there, to me that's different than a situation like a franchise or a situation like a particularly good chef or something like that.
But this valuation doesn't have any amount attributed to goodwill. It's all attributed to real estate. Am I right about that?
Right. And I would say the same issue applies when an office building is sold that's full. It's worth more. It's got leases. In fact, I'd argue that there's a better argument for a business value in an office building or an apartment building where you have a longer term leases, you have tenants, you don't have these transitional tenants that are gone in 2 months. So to me, I understand the argument, and even if that's a valid point, they still have a proof. If you look at Higbee, Higbee talks about separating business value and real estate value, and it's a matter of proof. That's what we mentioned. They simply didn't meet the proof, and that's why we feel that existing precedent is sufficient to resolve this case. This validation by their experts they talk about, it didn't match the 950. That's the other interesting point. And of course, it was all after the fact. So it's all an effort to sort of bootstrap what they've done, but it was simply not good evidence. Both experts admitted they'd never appraised this type of property before. And this is the sort of thing I think this court in the past has allowed the BTA to look at and make its own finding of fact.
Thank you, Mr. DiMuzio.
Thank you.
Ms. Fleming, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, we agree that existing precedent governs this case, but the existing precedent has exactly the opposite effect than what they're talking about. The existing precedent from your decisions in Lakota and Berea and so forth is that you follow the sale. The sale is very clear here. The conveyance fee statements that were filed, certified, verified under penalty of perjury with the county auditor for the two parcels said $975,000. That was confirmed in the real estate purchase contract. That is confirmed. They bought a title insurance policy for $1 million.
Counsel, I think we all understand what the documents show, but the point that the appellees has made here that any evidence that was presented to support the figure of almost one half attributed to goodwill was done after the fact. It was not engaged in with these experts to say, let me consult with you and figure out how much I'm going to spend for this property as a investor or a potential owner here, and how do we divvy this up? And in fact, is there any value to a goodwill here?
Yes, Your Honor. And Mr. Ullman testified, there is testimony in the record, how he came up with that allocation in making the contract with the other party is he determined, he's a real estate broker, a businessman, he determined what the land value is, he determined what it would take him to build the buildings, to get the business going, and then he looked at the question of whether it is an ongoing business, it has a workforce in place, it has a name, a phone number, a fax number, a trademark, and indeed that transient list, if you call it, that makes the service part of this retail operation even more important. The tenants aren't in possession. The tenants don't pay taxes and insurance and maintain the place, all those things that happen in long-term leases. The owner has to provide all those services to its retail tenants. And as this court recently held just about 10 days ago in the Dayton Montgomery case, as on the burden of proof issue, first there was the contract. There weren't appraisals presented at the Board of Revision because they had a contract and the cases call for following the contract. At the BTA, we brought in these independent appraisals, and that evidence was unrebutted by the appellees. In this court's decision in the Dayton Montgomery case, it says that that the presentation of evidence by a party who challenges the Board of Revision's determination, then the tendency of that evidence to undermine or contradict the Board of Revision's determination, that is that the Board of Revision said that there was no business when in fact in the record and cited in our brief on page 30 are the testimony of three witnesses that the business could be sold separately.
You need to sum up, Ms. Fleming.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. And then the failure, the absence of evidence on the other party to establish some different value for the business, which Mr. Sheevy conceded to exist. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.